plan against the grain. In an era of massive cuts to social services, the largesse of the wealthy seems a blessing. But what do the rich actually get in return for their philanthropy? Lindsay McGoy argues that they receive both financial benefits and great influence over policy. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with her about the history of philanthropy in the United States and the role of the Gates Foundation in shaping primary, secondary, and college education, pharmaceutical patents, and more, with very little media scrutiny. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The socialist Orange Tawney once reflected that what thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people, with equal justice, call the problem of riches. Which raises a pertinent question. Can the wealthy address the world's problems with their philanthropy, or are they part of the problem themselves? And what might the rich get in return for their tax-deductible donations? Sociologist Lindsay McGoy argues that charitable entities like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation wield enormous influence on public policy, both domestically, such as in championing privately run charter schools and funding think tanks and journalists, and globally, in limiting the availability of crucial pharmaceuticals. And, she notes, they've received a free pass from the media. McGoy teaches at the University of Essex in the UK and is the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy, which is published by Verso. Lindsay, almost half of the 85,000 foundations in the United States were started after the year 2000. What do you think accounts for this explosion of philanthropic entities?
People aren't really sure of a definitive answer. I think the sheer growth has actually taken even a lot of leading philanthropy experts by surprise. The number was hovering at about the 40,000 mark up until 2000. And then, as you say, from 2000 to 2015, the sheer number of foundations just exploded. And the number's now doubled. There's over 85,000 registered operating philanthropic foundations. And one of the reasons is that we're seeing a lot of greater wealth concentration, and a lot of very wealthy individuals want to place their money into a trust that they can oversee and that is able to dispense money over a number of years. So a lot of wealthy individuals are using philanthropic foundations as a vehicle for their philanthropic giving.
What are the, at least in the United States, what are the kind of restrictions that these foundations operate under, and what are the obvious benefits to those people who put their money into private foundations?
Sure. I mean, there's a number of important regulations that private foundations face. And if you have time, Sasha, in the interview, I'd like to maybe discuss, too, later on, that there's some new organizational entities which are emerging where people like Mark Zuckerberg are specifically choosing not to set up traditional private foundations, in part because they want to evade the regulatory restrictions that I'm going to talk about. So Zuckerberg's new philanthropic giving entity is a for-profit limited liability company, which is a whole different entity when it comes to the certain restrictions that I'll talk about facing more traditional foundations like the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. But essentially, foundations have been around for a long time, and they've gone through a number of changes over the decades. But they really got started in the early years of the turn of the 20th century. So in about 1914 to 1920, a number of foundations were endowed. And in the decades since, they faced an evolving list of different regulatory constraints and obligations placed on them that try to essentially make it a certainty that a certain amount of the money that's in an endowed foundation does get dispersed to people who need it. So essentially, some of the restrictions facing a traditional foundation would be that you can't place grants in institutions or recipient places that might financially benefit the founders of the philanthropic body. It's what's known as the self-dealing restriction. So it's a restraint on using your philanthropic investments to further your own private revenues, okay? So it's a restriction against private inurement or private benefiting from one's philanthropic disbursements. And then another regulation that these foundations face is that each year they have to have what's called a minimum payout, which means that they have to spend, at least in the U.S. case, at least 5% of their endowment each year towards various charitable causes of their own devising, okay? So that means that if you've got a body like the Gates Foundation, which is composed of actually two foundations, it's a bit complicated, but essentially in these two trusts, there's about, it hovers at the $40 billion mark each year, and it changes in line with some of its investments maybe doing better on the stock market than others. But it's got all this money in its endowment, and each year it has to spend up to, well, at least 5% of that on various causes. And so that's why you see often the Gates Foundation will be spending up to $2 billion or $3 billion annually, because it's trying to make sure that it meets its legal obligation to spend at least 5% of its endowment each year.
In the course of the hour, I'm sure you'll talk about the benefits to those people who put their money into foundations in a broad sense, but just in a very narrow sense, what benefits do the wealthy get in putting their money into a philanthropic foundation?
Well, they get a tax break, in essence. It's not that they avoid all income tax, but they can offset some of the money that's invested in that endowment against their tax liabilities, okay? And so it can be anywhere from, it depends, about 20 to 30%. I hate to list specific percentages because the tax code is extremely confusing and complicated, but they do get certain tax privileges, tax exemptions, where they're able to use the money in that endowment in order to offset some of their tax liabilities. I mean, there's a tax benefit in that they can offset, just like any individuals who are giving to a charity, you can offset against that donation, against your overall income tax liabilities. People who place their money in foundations avoid paying the full extent of their income tax or tax on something like a cap.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the history of philanthropy in the United States, especially coming from the super rich historically, people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, who in their times were termed robber barons.
Well, one of the leading early influential industrial benefactor was Andrew Carnegie, who was initially born in Scotland but moved to the U.S. at the young age when he was still in his very early teens, made a fortune in the steel industry, and very early on, even while he was in his late 20s and early 30s, was very adamant that he planned to bequest his money to furthering the cause of humanity, to trying to improve the livelihoods of people living in both the United States as well as in Scotland, as well later on as people living throughout the world through his endowments towards world peace. He was very against military intervention and tried to put his money towards improving the pursuit of peace. But his money was always very controversial because while he was amassing his fortune, there's two areas where I think his policies were quite controversial, and I think because of that controversy, he's a good exemplar for us to turn to when we think of some of the paradoxes surrounding these major benefactors today and whether their money is rooted in moral ways of amassing wealth. The first reason why Carnegie is quite controversial is because he was very involved in using quite aggressive tactics to suppress labor uprisings at his factories. He was, although occasionally he paid lip service to the benefits of union organizing, in private, he was very much focused on stamping out any union drives, any union organizing at his plants. So in 1889, he published this very famous essay, which was later retitled The Gospel of Wealth, where he argued that rich men have a duty to part with their fortunes because they have the skills and the expertise to oversee that money in a way that would ultimately benefit a larger community, but that the rich individuals, by virtue of their own business acumen, we're better placed to understand the needs of a community than a community itself. So he essentially argued that it was okay for the wages of his laborers to remain at a fairly low level and for them to work very onerous hours against their efforts to restrict their own working days to a more reasonable level. So he was insistent that they should retain 12-hour shifts when 12-hour shifts could be incredibly backbreaking for people involved in manual labor. And he resisted their urge to try to reduce their hours to a reasonable level. He resisted their efforts to try to develop collective bargaining rights in order to press for higher wages. So he was a very, in essence, militant, anti-union robber baron, and this is where he gets the nickname, he and other major industrialists at the end of the 19th century, they get this nickname, the robber barons, because working men essentially thought that they were stealing their own livelihoods away from them. They were stealing the wealth that should have been invested in the workers who were ultimately furthering the profits of people like Carnegie. That's one area. He was very virulently anti-union, even though it's not always recognized that that was his stance, because he was quite careful about it, and he channeled some of his more vociferous, aggressive anti-union activities through some of his senior management, rather than making it seem like the decisions to suppress union activities were coming from him. He was quite careful about making it seem, for example, like one of his major stewards, a man named Henry Clay Frick, he sort of made it seem like Frick was the one who was calling in the national militia to suppress unionists, calling in the Pinkerton Detective Agency. So there were very bloody battles going on at a number of Carnegie's plants, and Carnegie sort of took care to make it seem like he was absent from the front lines, like he was not overseeing the effort to suppress the union efforts, but actually historians have clearly shown that he was centrally involved in the anti-union efforts. The other reason which I think is quite important to remember where some of the wealth of these major industrialists came from is that Carnegie was constantly lobbying for very, very favorable tariffs on steel imports coming from outside the United States. So in many ways, his wealth could be attributed to national policies that were implemented by mostly Republican governments, and Carnegie was a staunch Republican, that really were opposed to free trade. So he was very much in favor of a protectionist policy that mostly benefited people who were already capital owners. And people pushing for more free trade at that time were actually more Democrats, who thought that if you could open up global competition, you could actually get to a position where the price of commodities might be lowered, where you've got a more fair economic system. And Carnegie, while his fortune was being amassed, was very anti-free trade. And it was only after the U.S. steel industry reached a place of global competitiveness that he later sort of did a volte-face. He changed his mind and insisted that free trade was the way to go. So he was quite hypocritical.
That's the voice of Lindsay McGoy. She is the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How does the philanthropy of today, sometimes labeled philanthrocapitalism, differ from that of robber barons like Andrew Carnegie?
We're seeing huge changes. We're seeing the philanthropic landscape shift almost unfathomably over the past 10 to 16 years, changes that have really coincided with the emergence of very large benefactors like the Gates Foundation. So let's talk about this new shift, philanthrocapitalism. It's not a term that I like personally. I'm not a fan of the term, but I think it's a good phrase to get us thinking about some of the new developments in philanthropy, which have really been, the new trends have been an emergence of what proponents call a shift towards for-profit philanthropy. Another change has been the rise in direct grants to corporations like MasterCard, which are increasingly receiving non-repayable gifts from bodies like the Gates Foundation. that they never have to pay back, regardless of how profitable those gifts become for the corporations. So it's been such a wind shift and change that it's hard to encapsulate all the developments. But
can you just explain what you just touched on? What do you mean that an entity like the Gates Foundation gives these finance companies this kind of money?
It's hard to almost understand or to explain, but that's exactly what's happening. Gates Foundation gave MasterCard $11 million to set up a lab for financial inclusion in Nairobi, in Kenya. So let's stand back and talk about why they did this, why they gave this money. Well, they claim that MasterCard is a well-placed entity to foster new forms of financial inclusion in a developing region like Kenya, okay? They say that what's happening in places like Kenya is that the poor don't have enough access to financial credit, and this is a way to help improve the livelihoods of the poor in places like Nairobi in Kenya, and so they are positioning companies like MasterCard to be able to supposedly provide more access to credit. Now, this might be plausible. There's no necessary objection to the idea that the poor do need better access to credit. That's a reality. My question is whether an extremely lucrative company like MasterCard, which operates in a not an entirely monopolistic fashion because there are other large major credit providers, credit companies like Visa, but I really question whether the monopolistic policy of enriching these already wealthy companies to expand into developing regions is a feasible model for charity, especially when, in essence, MasterCard has had incredible profitability over the past 5 to 10 years. It pays its executives $5-6 million salaries. And rather than try to have an internal rethinking of its own use of its own dividends by saying to itself, we will assume our own risk for rolling out our operations in Nairobi, because MasterCard has made it very clear that this is in some ways a business strategy for them, that it's financially useful and can be profitable to engage in developing regions, but that it's also a risky proposition. And so they have been on record praising the Gates Foundation for helping them to avoid some of the risk of expansion in a new market. Well, I think that's perhaps arguable, but I think that's not capitalism. That's just cronyism in a way. It's using a philanthropic body to offset the risk, the financial risk for expanding in a new area. And essentially, Gates Foundation is simply helping MasterCard to improve its own bottom line. And the Gates Foundation is calling this a charitable venture because the Gates Foundation argues that this gift to MasterCard is in line with its own charitable aim to improve what they call financial inclusion in poor nations. But I argue that actually, and I've been on record saying this, I think this is questionable legally, and I think this might skirt certain 501c3 regulations which try to inhibit private profiteering from a charitable grant.
Now, would this fall under the term that you mentioned a few minutes ago, for-profit philanthropy, which, you know, sounds like a contradiction in terms?
It would. This term, philanthrocapitalism, I haven't seen the Gates Foundation get behind it. They don't themselves espouse the term philanthrocapitalism. The term was coined by a person named Matthew Bishop, who's an editor at The Economist magazine, back in 2006. And he's the one who argues that we are seeing this new merging of the for-profit and the nonprofit sector in a really radical and revolutionary way that's set to unleash untold benefits for developing regions and for poor individuals living in wealthy nations. I think we are seeing a blurring of the boundaries between nonprofit entities and for-profit ones. Where I debate someone like Bishop is whether the benefits are necessarily clear for the most impoverished people living in these regions, or whether we're simply seeing the rise of something that I describe as the rise of rich-to-rich giving, where we're simply seeing places like the Gates Foundation, because they ultimately trust large corporations, they do think economic growth is sort of a good in its own right. They're willing to suggest that any economic expansion is beneficial in itself, And that's why they turn to a place like MasterCard, because they think a for-profit company might be, say, more risk-taking, more entrepreneurial. I'm not sure exactly what their defense is, because it's very hard to get the Gates Foundation to comment on things which one might be critical about. All I know is that when I asked them about the gift to MasterCard, they claimed that it was in line with their own charitable mission and therefore in line with IRS regulations, which do permit gifts to for-profit entities, but those gifts are meant to be used solely for charitable purposes. Now, that word solely is the key word, because I think it's clear that the gift to MasterCard is not being used solely. It's not being used only for charitable purposes. It's also being used for quite clear corporate expansion efforts. It's quite clearly aimed at increasing MasterCard's revenues.
Let's turn and talk about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is the focus of a sizable chunk of your book. They are the most powerful philanthropic charity in the world. Can you just start by giving us a sense of the scale of their influence?
They've played a huge role in shifting the education landscape in the United States, and they've also been extremely influential on the world scale. And I mean, I don't debate the fact that occasionally they've certainly done some good. They've increased awareness of the need to invest in global health, and I think that's a good development. I think because the Gates Foundation has been playing a strong role in trying to insist on the value of putting government money into global health, we're seeing, in some ways, a multiplier effect where certainly there's more money going towards battling both communicable diseases like malaria or tuberculosis, as well as, more recently, money going towards fighting chronic diseases, which increasingly account for the majority of preventable deaths, not simply in rich nations like the U.S. or the United Kingdom, but also in poor nations. But I think where you can maybe see their influence having a controversial effect is when it comes to schooling in the United States. And I'm sure there in California, is this something that you hear about a bit?
Indeed.
Where they're being quite influential on driving certain education policies.
Sure. So tell us about the orientation that the Gates Foundation has had in alliance with other foundations in trying to shape and successfully shaping elementary and secondary school education in the United States. What form has it taken?
Well, there's been three foundation players when it's come to education in the United States, and they are the Walton Family Trust, the Gates Foundation, and the Broad Foundation, which is set up by Eli Broad. And these three foundations together have essentially used targeted grants to lobby, although they wouldn't use a term like lobbying because that's traditionally prohibited by IRS regulations, but certainly they might favor a word like advocacy, where there's a little bit more legislative leeway. And they've essentially been instrumental in a number of different developments. The charter school expansion has been something that's been essentially, to a large degree, bankrolled by these foundations who are, I think, not necessarily positioning themselves to enable, say, a founder like Bill Gates to profit from his philanthropy. I don't think that's what he's trying to do. I genuinely think he is quite well-meaning when it comes to his own philanthropic efforts, and he is not trying to profit himself, but he's been very sanguine, very sort of complacent about the idea that allowing for a degree of profiting from the public education space is not necessarily a negative thing. So a lot of charter schools do operate on a for-profit basis in the United States, and that is extremely unusual in comparison to other nations. There's, in the UK certainly, although we have a very right-leaning government, and since the Thatcher years onwards, you've seen a lot of privatization of social services and a lot of profit capacity being built into public sector funding. Certainly, the public school system has been a realm that's managed to withstand this privatization turn, and that's got where profiting from essentially the provision of education to children at the elementary and secondary school level is prohibited. So the U.S. is quite an outlier in its willingness to allow private profiting from charter schools. And the big concern with them is that they lack the oversight of a traditional public school, and that tax dollars are being increasingly used to fund very, very exorbitant salaries and profits for the owners of different charter school franchises in a way that's not necessarily justifiable when it comes to student outcomes. So essentially, these wealthy charter school operator owners are getting value for nothing. They're using tax dollars, so they're not assuming much risk, and they're able to profit from the provision of substandard schooling. And the Gates Foundation, by essentially putting a lot of money into grassroots groups that lobby for charter school expansion, has really been at the forefront of the charter school turn. Another controversial area, which I'm sure you're familiar with in California and, of course, throughout the United States, has been this drive towards pay-for-performance teaching. Mm-hmm. So the Gates Foundation was at the forefront of trying to introduce certainly a lot more standardized testing. And although they weren't the pioneers of what's called value-added measures, they certainly put a lot of money into it. And this value-added testing, value-added approaches to education are where you try to isolate the effect that a teacher has had on the outcome of a child's education. And this is something that's traditionally been very hard to do because, and it still is hard to do, and that's because it's very, very hard to disaggregate what the effect of a teacher has been when so many other external factors, such as poverty, a parent's access, level of education, things like malnutrition, things like access to shelter. There's huge and growing homeless problems in the United States. And all these things can affect how well a child does at school. The Gates Foundation was initially at the forefront of people who said, well, we know that those things matter. We're not denying that. But we feel that where our money can really help is on the teacher's performance itself and trying to improve that. And so we're going to introduce these new value-added standardized testing measures that try to essentially isolate out the teacher's effect. And that's been very, very controversial because it's very hard to do, and it leads to a lot of unintended effects, where a lot of teachers are penalized for essentially what has been shown to be faulty statistical measures. Most recently, the Gates Foundation has done something of a public mea culpa. They've said, we were wrong, we were wrong, we were wrong. We were wrong about these efforts to really isolate the teacher's effectiveness, and we're backing away from our push to roll out value-added testing mechanisms across the nation. So in some ways, I admire the way they're willing to say we were wrong. The problem is, unless they back away from a decision, there's very few cases where the Gates Foundation has responded to a lot of long-standing criticism of its activities, and there's absolutely no democratic way to essentially make sure that they are responsive to communities who their philanthropy does affect, sometimes negatively. And unlike, say, an elected official or an elected party, there's no mechanism for ensuring a democratic necessity to respond to a constituency.
Lindsay McGoy is my guest. We'll return with her in a moment. Thank you. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the price of philanthropy. I'm speaking with the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, and that's published by Verso. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. Lindsay McGoy is senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Essex. You were speaking a moment ago about one of the major problems with philanthropic entities and the very wealthy people who fund them having the kind of power that they do to shape public policy, because, as you say, there are no way to hold them accountable, unlike, at least in theory, people in government. One area where the Gates Foundation has had a large impact has been around global health. And I wonder if you could talk about what has been problematic in their intervention there, much celebrated, that they were putting their money towards health, which is obviously vastly underfunded. Why are you concerned about that dimension of the Gates Foundation's work?
I think some of the negative implications are less clear in the global health realm. And certainly, I think there are some initiatives which the Gates Foundation has been supportive of, which are beneficial, such as, for example, a lot of funding towards Gavi, which is the Vaccine Alliance. And I do think that an increased access to different vaccines internationally is a positive development. There's two things to talk about when it comes to the Gates Foundation and health. One is that you say that health is underfunded, and that is the case, that global health started to be in some ways less of a priority area around the mid-90s, and that's been almost completely revolutionized by a few new players getting involved and insisting that governments need to invest in global health. But no matter that it was traditionally a bit less funded, it is still the case that what the Gates Foundation puts towards global health is simply a drop in the bucket compared to what government actors spend. The overseas development assistance that the U.S. government contributes to aid generally, but also global health initiatives, it's just in the multi-billions, and it dwarfs the amount that the Gates Foundation offers. So one of my big aims in the book was to point out that we often hear statistics such as Gates Foundation is saving countless malaria lives or saving countless lives by preventing malaria deaths, or Gates Foundation has played a central role in improving levels of maternal mortality worldwide. Now, it's true that we're seeing a drop in global maternal mortality internationally. One of the outliers on that is actually the U.S., which has a quite high maternal mortality rate in comparison to other wealthy nations,
right,
and is really lagging behind this general global trend. But the positive is that internationally you are seeing gains when it comes to improvements in maternal mortality. Now, on a pure dollar basis, that achievement, that gain, is really attributable to both developing countries making headway in their own commitments to their populaces, as well as the huge amount that's invested by governments in providing health aid. So just on a sheer dollar basis, what the Gates Foundation offers, it's simply a drop in the bucket. It's negligible compared to what wealthy nations cumulatively put towards global health initiatives. So I get a little frustrated when I sense that the Gates Foundation is, in essence, punching above its weight. It's getting a lot of reputational capital, and it's actually perpetuating, I think, something that's dangerously false, which is the idea that governments are doing nothing when it comes to health commitments, or that loan entrepreneurs are somehow uniquely responsible for these huge gains that we see in health rises or health gains across the world. And so I, in some ways, wanted to point out a corrective to this new mythology we're seeing arising surrounding this perception that it's lone entrepreneurs somehow saving the world, when on a dollar basis, it's just simply not the case. What the Gates Foundation puts towards global health doesn't even compare remotely to what different health bodies like the World Bank spend or bodies like the U.S. government.
Well, bearing that in mind, the kudos that the Gates Foundation receives may be outsized compared to their actual contributions. Bearing that in mind, what has been the impact of the Gates Foundation's stance on patent protection and pharmaceuticals in terms of its real-world implications?
This is, I would say, the main concern with the Gates Foundation's global health activities. Essentially, it's very hard to understand or to get a clear statement from the Gates Foundation on what its approach to patent protections is. So just to give a quick overview, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will already be familiar with some of these challenges surrounding access to medicines, but a lot of policymakers, a lot of developing nations, a lot of non-governmental organizations, such as Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, which have taken a lead role in trying to point out that currently the protections that are in place to allow pharmaceutical companies to benefit from their own patented technologies, well, a certain degree of patent protection is necessary to essentially reward risk-taking. People say, and I agree very strongly with this, that the entire system for protecting the patent rights of large, often U.S.-based multinationals is really, really, really strongly militates against the effort to procure access to affordable medicines in developing countries. We've seen this time and time again. The main paradigmatic case that is still upheld as a reason why you often need legislation in place that permits companies to produce drugs at a cheaper rate than they might be if they're fully reliant on patented medicines is the HIV sort of pandemic across the world, and particularly in South Africa back in 2001. You saw the South African government taken to court by a consortium of pharmaceutical manufacturers who were opposed to the South African government's effort to try to essentially use its own domestic laws to commission the manufacture and the import of cheap generic medicines which could lower the treatment of an average HIV sufferer, in essence, from about $12,000 per head to less than $10 per person. So we had the technology in place to vastly lower the cost of getting HIV medicines, antiretroviral medicines, to infected individuals. But this effort was countered by a consortium of pharmaceutical manufacturers, including major players like GlaxoSmithKline, who essentially were suing the South African government for taking this preventative, or not simply preventative, this simply treatment active plan to try to reduce the health burden that its own citizens were facing. And when this happened, eventually the pharmaceutical manufacturers dropped their suit. They lost the battle. And this led to a lot of efforts to try to improve the international legislation that governs access to medicines. And it's governed by the World Trade Organization. And since 2001, a lot of gains have been made in trying to develop more mechanisms to obtain better access to medicines, but we're certainly still a long, long, long way off from where a lot of international health activists would like to see us be when it comes to essentially deterring the U.S. government from bullying smaller countries when they want to import medicines cheaply, because certainly that's what the U.S. government does do quite often. And the concern is that Mr. Gates himself has never once spoken in favor of the health activists' efforts to improve access to medicines. And not only has he not spoken in favor of their efforts to improve patent restrictions, he has been very vocal in supporting the current international patent system and suggesting that it is no barrier to access to affordable medicines in poor nations. I think that he is simply on that stance of his. I think it's an ideologically driven stance. I think it's one that certainly he was strongly in favor of patent protections when he was involved at Microsoft. He was certainly been in favor of increasing patent protections in a way that I think is contrary to the Gates Foundation's global health mission.
Well, let me ask you about the role of the Gates Foundation in Africa, particularly to do with agriculture.
I focused in my book more on the education landscape and health, and I only touched briefly in one chapter on its efforts with agriculture. So I don't think I am necessarily the best expert to talk about some of its work in this area with a great deal of specificity. I can only give you the broad strokes. And I do think that they are evolving their stance when it comes to agriculture, so it's important to check back regularly with where they're placing their endowments, with whether they're shifting their position on certain approaches, because I think they, particularly when it comes to agriculture, have tried to be open to the concerns over some of their past practices. So you might hear, for example, that the Gates Foundation is invested in Monsanto. That's no longer the case anymore. They did hold shares in the past, but they have divested from their Monsanto shares. And equally, they've divested from other problematic corporations that I think their strong position and hold in really undermined their global health mission. So, for example, they had a 7% of their endowment was invested in McDonald's at one stage, and 9% of their whole endowment was invested in Coca-Cola. And I think most problematically, a lot of the Gates Foundation money actually comes from its shares in its gift from Warren Buffett's shares in Berkshire Hathaway. So at least half of the Gates Foundation's endowment does, well, not actually half currently, but once Mr. Buffett's pledge to gift $30 billion worth of Berkshire Hathaway pledges shares is fully offered to the Gates Foundation, which is a gift that's taking place in incremental stages. At some stage, half the endowment might be composed of Mr. Buffett's company and not Mr. Gates's. But they did divest from Monsanto. They eventually shed almost all their shares in Coca-Cola and McDonald's, which are welcome developments, I think, because at one stage, the Gates Foundation was poised to be the largest shareholder of Coca-Cola in the world. And I think that's a problematic tension when you have a body that's as publicly committed to improving public health as the Gates Foundation, for it to be so strongly involved or invested in Coca-Cola was one of the main reasons why I wanted to write my book, to talk about that tension and to say, well, we know that Coca-Cola is involved in some problematic marketing tactics. We know that it was funding scientists based at Harvard and elsewhere to try to deny the possibility that sugary drinks could lead to obesity problems. So we know that the Coca-Cola was involved in some very problematic efforts to undermine the science of obesity research, and yet at the same time you have a body like the Gates Foundation strongly partnering with Coca-Cola and investing a lot of its endowment in this company. But they got out of Coca-Cola, they got out of Monsanto, but what they haven't done is stepped away from the position that they argue Monsanto should play a strong role in improving agricultural processes in countries in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. And why I think that's problematic is whether you're a believer in genetically modified organisms or not, whether you believe in GMOs, and I personally am agnostic about their benefits because I simply don't think we know enough about it, partly because a lot of the science has been commercially protected and there's prohibitions against independent researchers testing many of the products. But regardless of whether you're a fan of GMOs or not, my main concern was more the economic model of improving Monsanto's almost monopolistic position in regions of sub-Saharan Africa when a lot of African voices were saying this is stifling competition, this is preventing us from being able to improve small holdings, this is preventing farmers from re-harvesting seeds. They have to always procure more and more seeds from Monsanto or face major legal challenges. So I think the Gates Foundation is slightly blind, frankly, to some of the negative effects of monopolistic competition when it comes to economic growth. And this is my main concern with their tendency to be what I call corporate populists. They are strongly in favor of corporate solutions to some of the world's strongest health and agriculture limitations. And I don't always think that a corporate involvement in these realms is a good idea, especially when markets are in their infancy and we need to let smaller countries catch up.
Lindsay McGoy is my guest. She is the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. One of the things that you write in your book, No Such Thing as a Free Gift, is that you were motivated to write about the Gates Foundation partially because, despite their enormous size, there has been little critical attention paid to their actions. Certainly in the media, you can find all sorts of accolades, sometimes every day. But in terms of critical inquiry, there's not very much. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. I would love an answer to that, a firm answer. I think that a lot of its money is put towards causes that you or I or anyone would agree with. We all hope to see children educated in an equitable way. That means people from poor families or rich ones have an equal shot at a sound and robust and comprehensive education. And this is what the Gates Foundation maintains its mission is about. As they say publicly, their view is that all lives have equal value. And I think that's not simply a palatable mission statement. It's almost a sacred one. And I think that process of almost sanctifying the moral position they are coming from makes it incredibly hard for people to criticize any of the process of their philanthropic expenditures or the effects, because it means that people feel as if they are criticizing what is most special and laudable and admirable about any of us, which is our desire to try to be, if we can, selfless individuals. And so the sheer amount of the Gates Foundation's giving makes Mr. Gates and Mrs. Gates seem almost saintly in their approach, which is something that my colleague Darren Thiel and I write about, because as sociologists, we're really interested in the moral implications that underpin different activities. But my fear is that that desire not to criticize a morally blameless stance means that a lot of power is invested in a small group of individuals, and the goal of the Gates Foundation to improve equality is actually undermined through their own tendency to gift large gifts to other corporations, to arguably, but I think quite plausibly, you can make an argument they are undermining democratic institutions when they have such a strong influence on education policy that Mr. Gates can be sort of jokingly in a way that resonates with a lot of people, referred to as the shadow minister of education in the United States. You know that this individual has a lot of power. And my concern is that even though their aims are laudable, their very philanthropic choices might be undermining the very goals that they're trying to achieve.
What about philanthropic foundations' influence on the media? I'm not just speaking of the Gates Foundation, but in the United States, much of public broadcasting, for example, is underwritten by charitable foundations as well as for-profit companies. Do you think that's led in any way to less scrutiny of the role of private foundations, philanthropic entities, in their role, their outsized role in the last decades?
When it comes to their influence on media, I'll say bluntly, I think you hear this a lot, and it can be a knee-jerk reaction to say the mainstream media is asleep at the wheel. I think quite clearly, when it comes to essentially the fawning way that any announcement by any of these new philanthropists, not just the Gateses, but increasingly people like Mark Zuckerberg, whose recent pronouncements that 3 billion will end disease by the end of 2100, it's a slightly ludicrous claim, because what $3 billion amounts to is less than 1% of what the U.S. government will invest on basic health research over the next 10 years. So these patently quite obvious ludicrous claims emanating from people like Mr. Zuckerberg are not being treated with the skepticism and the due diligence that they deserve by either media groups. And also, I'd like to see different legislative bodies taking more of an interest into whether or not 501c3 regulations are really being adhered to as strongly as they should be.
That, of course, being the tax code for nonprofit entities.
That's right. And the interesting thing with Mr. Zuckerberg's new entity is that it's not, of course, subject to those same tax provisions because it is a for-profit limited liability company. So it's not actually a charity at all. And yes, it doesn't have some of the same tax benefits of a charity, but also Mr. Zuckerberg himself certainly does assume a lot of income tax benefits by shifting shares in Facebook to this new limited liability company. And despite those strong tax exemptions, we'll know a lot less about his entity than we do about the Gates Foundation, because whether you like the Gates Foundation or not, at least I think you have to commend the fact that they're quite public about where all their money is going. Legally, they have to be, so they're just following the legal rules there. But they make their grants really easy to access and to search through, whereas donors like the Koch brothers, I mean, trying to really scrutinize where their grants are going is possible, but a lot less easy than with the Gates Foundation. But when it comes to Mr. Zuckerberg's new entity, as a limited liability company, it does not face the same onus to disclose every investment or grant it makes to the public. So we may never know where all its money is going. It could all be legally going to for-profit recipients, and we'll never know.
We are entirely out of time. Lindsay McGoy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Sasha. Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy. That's published by Verso Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Essex. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.